says the honor goes only to the one who never ever worshipped an idol. Because most of the majority of the Sahaba were all mushrikeen before. And that is why you'll see that the Muslim world says that Ali, when they used to describe him, they would say, Karramallahu wajhu. Karramallahu wajhu means, may Allah honor his face. Because this forehead of Ali has never ever bowed down in front of an idol. Combining the story of, removing the idol from the roof of the Kaaba, and Ali standing on the shoulders of Rasulullah, with this issue of sitting on the minbar, in a way, Ibn Shahr Ashub is trying to say that, if Ali can stand on the shoulders of Rasulullah, what problems do you have that if Ali sits on the same level as the minbar of Rasulullah?
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In the early hours of Sunday, massive explosions rocked the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, Erbil. A dozen ballistic missiles hit secret Mossad bases there, reportedly leaving several Israeli operatives dead. Then, a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles targeting a strategic center for conspiracy and evil acts of the Zionists. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. It underlined that the security of Iranian nationals was the red line of the country's armed forces. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. There have been a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria, as requested by the Damascus government. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting public outcry. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for the Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country.
Iran's retaliatory strike against an informal Israeli base in Iraq, which was in response to an act of Israeli aggression in Syria, which resulted in the deaths of two members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, serves as another stark reminder to Israel's ruling elite, namely that Iran has the intent and the capability to effectively respond to acts of Israeli aggression, either against Iran directly, or against Iranian interests in the Middle East, or against Iran's allies in the Middle East, such as Syria. And I am of the opinion that the Iranian retaliatory strike against the unofficial Israeli base in Iraq will not be lost on the Israeli ruling elite.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's 1967 occupation of the Arab country's Golan Heights. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as a launchpad for its attacks on the Syrian soil. Israel has attacked Syria repeatedly through the past years. The reasons it provides fall short of being enough to justify the death and destruction that it has caused. Tel Aviv has been a key supporter of terrorist groups fighting to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since March 2011. The regime has also been providing safe passage and medical treatment to the Takfiri terrorists who flee the Allies' defensive operations. Israel's recent attack on the Syrian capital led to the martyrdom of two Iranian military advisors with the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The elite military force has been providing Syria with military advisory assistance in the face of foreign-sponsored militancy.
Iran has developed a very strong and a very robust armed forces which can meet Israeli aggression. Nonetheless, the Israelis, because of the unconditional support they receive year on year from Washington, will continue to act in the most criminal way possible.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Isn't it time the UN or other world countries gave this the attention that it deserves before the situation spirals out of control?
The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictory remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the US. Why is the US hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories on the Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. the close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got, hanging over all of this, the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that it can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research. You had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of U.N. conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Babul Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kadhim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام جهاد المرأة حسن التبعل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, The jihad of a woman is to be of excellent service to her husband.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, peace be upon him, we find that on many occasions he advised his companions to cling to patience, to hold on firmly to patience, and especially so when they are faced with a disaster or a misfortune. Now, if we explain this before we talk about what Imam al-Kadhim said, we find that impatience takes away the reward Allah has prepared for the patient. And we find in the Holy Quran, in many places, of course, that Allah is with the patient, and Allah considers the patient to be victorious and to be prosperous and successful. And so from the other traditions that we have and in these other conversations of the divinely appointed imams, we find that they give us a whole host and variety and kinds of reasons to be patient. Here, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, "One is not worthy of the reward of a misfortune except through patience," and saying, "We belong to Allah, and to Allah is our return." Here, dear friends, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is talking about the verse of the Holy Quran, the word of Allah, where the Almighty Allah says, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." We belong to Allah, and to Allah is our return. So this is one of the things that we say during misfortune. And if we remain patient during misfortunes and trials and tribulations and disasters, not only will we succeed and overcome the said disaster and misfortune, but through the patience, we will also gain a great reward. It is interesting, but this statement of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam directly reminds me of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the third divinely appointed Imam. For when the trials and tribulations and misfortunes and calamities had reached a peak, we hear that it was Imam al-Hussein who said, "We belong to Allah, and to Allah is our return." This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
There are a number and a countless narratives from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, in the idea that the religion of Islam is not a religion of individualism. It's not a religion of monasticism. It's not a religion that practices or advocates celibacy, whereby an individual lives like a hermit and isolates themselves. The religion of Islam encourages community service, social activeness. The religion of Islam, when it comes to the Holy Quran, over 200 verses, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks to the community. You and I, when we speak to Allah, we speak in the plural sense. We say, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. And when we say the tashahhud, السَّلَامُ عَلَيْنَا, we speak as a community, collectively. Why? Because the religion of Islam has come forward and said that when it comes to seeking the path of success and satisfaction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this will not be possible if an individual isolates themselves and thinks about themselves and themselves only. Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala has created us as communities, as tribes, as nations. And one of the more important things that emerged from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far is the need to understand the urgency by which the narrations and before that the Quran speak about when it comes to fulfilling the hajat of your brothers and sisters. Someone comes and asks you to help him or her fulfill something, get something done.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا من قد جئت فينا بالهدى والحب دينا أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله من ندى عينيك نور اسمك الحاني
In the limelight.
Access to water is among the many issues examined by Amnesty International in its recently published report documenting how the Zionist regime runs an apartheid system. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Feda Al-Ghidra, writer. This article is published under the heading Pollution on Tap in Gaza. Here's the story. Sana Abu Al-Ata is constantly waiting for water. She often keeps the faucets open so that she will be able to hear the sound of liquid flowing through them. Sometimes she stays awake all night listening. Water arrives at irregular intervals in her home, and when water does arrive, it is invariably of poor quality. Abu Al-Ata said the water is so salty. Abu Al-Ata is a resident of Deir al-Balah refugee camp in central Gaza, adding, "It's like it comes straight from the sea. It damages our skin and hair." After a rash appeared on her daughter's skin, she was advised to use bottled water while washing. Costing around 60 cents per liter, bottled water is unaffordable for most people in Gaza, where poverty and unemployment are widespread. Bottled water has increased in price over recent months, along with food and drinks generally. Access to water is among the many issues examined by Amnesty International in its recently published report documenting how the Zionist regime runs an apartheid system. The report states that the Zionist regime has consolidated complete control of all water resources and water-related infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, including the coastal aquifer, which is the only freshwater resource in Gaza. Due to over-extraction and pollution, more than 95% of water from the coastal aquifer is unfit for human consumption. no transfer of water from the occupied West Bank to Gaza is allowed by the Zionist regime, the Amnesty report adds. The Zionist regime, the occupying power, charges hefty sums to supply Gaza with water. The annual bill paid to the Zionist regime is around $20 million. Importing from the occupied territories is necessary, according to Mazen Al-Banna, a senior Gaza-based representative of the Palestinian Water Authority. The coastal aquifer does not yield enough water to meet the needs of farmers, factories, and households. Al-Banna said, "We live in a narrow geographical area. This means that water resources are limited. Rather than demand that the Zionist regime ensures all Palestinians have access to clean water, some high-ranking diplomats have actually praised the Zionist regime's inherently racist policies. In November last year, the UN West Asia Region envoy Tor Wensland noted that the Zionist regime had taken steps towards selling an additional 5 million cubic meters of water to Gaza per year. That, according to Wensland, was a positive development. Not all diplomats share Wensland's habit of sugarcoating the occupation. In September, Michelle Bachelet, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, presented a report that criticized the Zionist regime's destruction of Palestinian infrastructure. The report stated that around 290 water and sanitation facilities were destroyed or damaged by the Zionist regime when it attacked Gaza in May. Bachelet's report observed that safe drinking water has become virtually unaffordable in Gaza, where poverty and unemployment are widespread. Some 20,000 families do not have enough money to buy clean water. Those families rely, according to Bachelet's report, on water from public filling points or unsafe tap water, with high risk of waterborne diseases, particularly among children under five. The water from Muhammad al-Zain's faucets is usually colored gray or yellow. "We just use tap water for cleaning and bathing," said Al-Zain, who lives in Beit Hanun, northern Gaza, adding, "The water doesn't seem suitable for anything, but we have no choice. When my kids take a shower, they complain that their eyes get sore and red. Their hair tends to be very dry and they need moisturizers for their skin. Polluted water causes damage." Al-Zain recently had to change taps and siphons in his bathroom because they were clogged with rust and lime. "It was very expensive," he said. He also noted that the water is too dirty even for the plants and fruit trees in his garden. "The problems of access to water have been compounded by the full blockade, which the Zionist regime has imposed on Gaza for more than 15 years. One consequence of the siege is that Gaza frequently encounters power outages." Abed Omar is a father of five living in Beach refugee camp, Gaza City. The pump which he uses to fill containers with water runs on electricity. In the winter, his family usually has access to water for 5 hours per day. But during summertime, they tend to only have water once every 2 or 3 days. He said, "When we don't have water and electricity at the same time, we can't fill our containers. So we have no water for days at a time. It is so difficult."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Culture, Politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds. And peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny, especially the one remaining with God on earth. I congratulate the entire great Islamic Ummah, the dear Iranian nation, and all liberated individuals in the world on the occasion of the auspicious and grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Ba'atha is the day when the greatest divine gift was bestowed on the Holy Prophet of Islam. God's greatest servant in Mab'ath Eve prayer, Ba'atha, has been described as the great light. Of course, the Holy Prophet's Ba'atha is a gift to all of humanity as well. If we only consider two values from among all Islamic values, the expansion of rationality and the cultivation of morality, of course, Islamic values are vast in scope, but those two values are outstanding. And if we wish to see what Islam has mentioned about these two values, we will confirm that Islam has given the best gift and the means for bliss to humanity.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The fact that Islam invites people to the expansion of rationality is very important. There are tens of, and perhaps about 100, ayahs and verses in which God, the Exalted, invites people to thinking and deliberating with terminologies such as thinking, learning, understanding, and the like. As for the expansion and cultivation of morality, it would be enough to say that Islam has placed morality at the top of the goals of Ba'atha. In several ayahs of verses in the Holy Quran, morality has been highlighted, such as in this verse, It is He who has sent amongst the unlettered an apostle from among themselves to recite them His signs, to purify them. Chapter 62, verse 2. There are other ayahs and verses in the Holy Quran in which morality has been mentioned as the goal of Ba'athah. Morality is at the top of all goals. Therefore, Islam has given these two lofty values to humanity and has invited believers and all human beings to think and to cultivate morality. This is the biggest gift that Islam could have given to humanity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations WFP has expressed concern about the situation of children in Afghanistan, announcing that acute malnutrition rates are high in 28 out of 34 provinces of the country. The UN body says 3.5 million Afghan children currently need nutrition treatment. The head of Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital believes this situation is due to cuts in global aid and mass poverty triggered by U.S. sanctions.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers can't afford enough nutrients at the time of pregnancy. When the mother herself suffers from undernutrition, the baby, of course, becomes malnourished. In addition to providing milk and nutrients, health bodies should also provide such families with some cash aid for a specific period of time so that the mother and children don't face malnourishment after recovering.
Some Afghan mothers also say they can't provide their babies with needed nutrition, as their entire families are going without food to eat.
I'm a widow. I can't afford a packet of flour to cook bread. My family members are going without food to eat. There is no male breadwinner in our household. This daughter of mine is malnourished, and I'm afraid the other children also become undernourished if this situation continues.
The UNHCR says that at the Antalya Diplomacy Forum, everyone agreed that in spite of the extreme gravity of the Ukraine situation, other crises, including that of Afghanistan, must not be forgotten. Afghans are also calling on Western powers not to ignore the crisis they caused in Afghanistan.
Western powers caused the situation in our country. They imposed the war and controlled everything here. Today they are shifting all attention to the Ukraine crisis. That is important, but what about Afghans' plight? They shouldn't forget poor and suffering Afghans.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and major funding to the country was halted. The developments affected lives across the country.
The situation is still perilous in Afghanistan, where millions of lives depend on foreign aid. Afghan people are calling on world countries not to forget them and to continue their assistance to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Majlis-e-Wahdat Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia targeted killings emerge in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims.
Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate mongering to root out this threat from the society.
After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities Pasmane Azad Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signaling another wave of Shia targeted killing following the same decades old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises. First in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result, came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last three decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
With the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, being just around the corner in Iran, people are getting prepared to welcome the arrival of spring. This comes as the sixth wave of coronavirus in Iran appears to have been subsiding now. The official daily number of fatalities, which had stood at 241 on February 27th, fell to below 120 over the past couple of days. The Persian New Year, or Nowruz, arrives on March 21st. The Nowruz holidays are traditionally a time when Iranians travel and visit each other. But health officials are worried that the exchange of visits and travels during the Persian New Year will lead to a new wave of COVID-19 if health protocols are not fully observed.
In view of the special feature of the Omicron variant, we highly request people to keep wearing masks and observe social distancing. Although many of them have been vaccinated, wearing a mask is still an important measure, especially when they are visiting relatives and friends during Nowruz.
I think everyone should receive the third dose of vaccine. And if you want to be safe, we should postpone our visiting and travels to some other time. If we don't take Omicron seriously, the next wave will sweep across the country again.
I have recovered from coronavirus almost 20 days now, but too much coughing hurts me a lot, and symptoms are still with me and my daughter. It's a bad disease, and people should not forget to observe the health protocols.
According to official statistics, over 56 million Iranians have received the second jabs of vaccines, while over 24 million others have been vaccinated with the third shot.
Under the travel rules released for Iran's third Nowruz with COVID-19, only those who have received at least two doses of vaccines are allowed to travel by their private cars across the country during the Persian New Year holidays. Otherwise, they will be fined. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a big ceremony to mark the 54th anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars. Israeli forces have also injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Hamas movement, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of committing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The amount, the volume, the size of the injury indicated that we are facing a criminal side, which is occupation. I think it is very important indication about the type and the impact of the Israeli actions, Israeli crimes against the Palestinian.
During the Israeli war in May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation.
We have to stress the role of the wounded in Palestine and their, their great role. They are Palestinian, wounded are in the first line with the occupation. So they sacrifice with their bodies in order to, free Palestine.
Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries. The Islamic Jihad movement accused the United States of encouraging Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
I think that who gives the Israeli the green light? Americans. The United States of America